This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, KDLG's weekly news magazine. It's Friday, November 13th, but only good luck today as we're glad to have you joining us. Coming up in the next half hour, BBRSDA Board President Abe Williams talks about their new executive director and other business, plus that gloomy feeling that's settled in for many on account of next year's huge sockeye forecast.
You know, we have one of the most robust fisheries in the world, but it certainly presents problems from an economic point of view.
But don't let that get you down. At least that's what an old KDLG friend has to say as he tells us about an important milestone Bristol Bay is going to reach next summer.
Whoever catches the 2 billionth salmon next year will never be known. Fishing will probably be fast and furious. Anyone could claim credit for catching the 2 billionth salmon. And everyone should.
That's billionth with a B, like in Bob. We'll get an update on those standardized test results, known as AMP, that are making waves in the education world this week. Plus, check in on those Lady Wolverines just ahead of this weekend's at-home Spike Fest tournament. For our Friday conversation, Professor Todd Radenbaugh joins us to talk about why wind power has not yet become a reality in Dillingham.
You need to have a location where you have consistently strong winds, and your windmills need to be able to capture that wind as much of the year as possible.
Those stories are coming up after a brief look back at some of the week's news. Last Friday, we reported that gas prices in Dillingham had dropped below the $5 mark for the first time since most could remember. Pumping up at $4.75 a gallon at the Bristol Express Friday, Ty Mueller said he was certainly pleased with the price.
Oh, I would say fill up once a week. So this is a considerable help. Absolutely.
Heating oil dropped as low as $3.20 a gallon, the lowest price since 2004 when it bottomed out at $2.17. The city of Dillingham announced the high bidder for the properties formerly owned by Jim Bingman, that being Chogyung Investments, which offered $429,000 in the auction. The only other bidder offered about $25,000 less. The city foreclosed on the properties, mostly apartment buildings, last summer, citing close to $400,000 owed in back taxes, utilities, and legal fees. City Project Manager Steve Cropsey told the council he expects Chogyung to take ownership of the buildings early next month.
As soon as the funds come in, the deed will be prepared and ready to exchange. And that's how the closing happens on this kind of a transaction.
The city is currently acting as landlord for the roughly 11 tenants, some of whom are current on rent and some who are not. On Monday, the State Department of Education released the results of last spring's standardized test, known as AMP, following weeks of delay. Superintendents had warned the results would be low on the new test, and they were proved correct. Statewide, only 35% of students met standards for language arts, and only 31% met standards in math. The department, some superintendents, and some lawmakers say they want the test fixed or replaced. Juneau's Amy Jo Miners was named Alaska's 2016 Teacher of the Year at a conference last weekend in Anchorage. Dillingham's Teresa Duncan came in third. On Monday morning, a 6.3 magnitude earthquake shook the waters off the Aleutian Islands, with its epicenter near the island of Atka. It was the largest in a series of similar-sized quakes occurring at shallow depths off the Aleutian Islands in the past month. On Wednesday, a big storm slammed into the eastern Aleutians and the western portion of the Alaska Peninsula. Wind gusts of 93 miles an hour were recorded, and seas up to 43 feet were predicted on the Pacific side as the storm made landfall. Unalaska reported broken windows and downed streetlights. One person was treated for minor injuries. Dillingham residents voiced their concerns Monday night about a potential road improvement project in the Nurka subdivision. The project aims to see an access road connect Teal Lane to Emperor. Dan Dunaway was among those who say that'll turn the neighborhood into a thoroughfare.
Some people get going way too fast, and there's lots of little kids in that area, and just concerned that it'd kind of be a raceway or turn into a feeder.
The $7.5 million project, which includes resurfacing for other roads, has not yet been funded. Later this month, the MySpace Youth Center at SAFE in Dillingham will likely be closed as its grant funding has run out. Outreach coordinator Karen Carpenter says if that happens, the community will lose an important resource.
Kids are going to go where the door's opened. So which door are you going to leave open for them? You know, it's going to be the home of the drug dealer, or, you know, the drinking and the parents fighting and screaming and there's no food in the house, there's no electricity, there's no heat. So if we provide this safe environment, it affects them, it changes them. So our goal has been to keep the right doors open.
SAFE says it's seeking additional grants and donations to keep MySpace open. And yesterday, former EPA staffer Phil North was a no-show for a deposition in Anchorage. The Pebble Limited Partnership has alleged North was instrumental in EPA's work to develop preemptive restrictions against the mine, and Judge H. Russell Holland issued a subpoena for him to appear. North left the country after his retirement, and his whereabouts are currently unknown. Pebble says it will keep trying to find him to serve the subpoena. The EPA says it has no information or comment about its retired employees. More on this week's news can be found at our website, kdlg.org. You're listening to Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. I'm Dave Benninger. The Regional Seafood Development Association for Bristol Bay, which is funded by a 1% tax on the harvest of all drift net fishermen, has hired a new executive director. Sue Asplin announced her resignation last spring after a year on the job. I spoke with BBRSDA's board president, Abe Williams, earlier today for more. Abe, good morning.
Good morning.
Tell us a little bit about your new executive director here, Becky Martello.
Yeah, Becky comes to us from the Alaska Marine Safety Education Association, where she served as the director and assistant director. And she's also worked for the Aleutians Pribilofs CEQ group as well. She's earned a bachelor's degree for administration and management from the University of Southeast Alaska as well.
And she's Naknek, born and raised, is that the case?
Well, she wasn't born here, but she was certainly raised here, and she's spent most of her youth out in Bristol Bay as well, and has participated in the fishery.
It was kind of a long search, it seems like, to get the role filled after Sue announced her resignation last April.
Yeah, you know, it was a rather daunting task.
Abe, what is the RSDA sort of up to here in this sort of lag between the end of the fishing season? We've got Board of Fish coming up, Pacific Marine Expo. What's the RSDA sort of been up to of late?
Well, you know, we've been working on quite a few items. Our committees, we have a committee that's working on quality issues and incentives for our fleet in a possible program. And we also have a marketing committee that's been working on a fairly robust proposal and plan to help with the marketing of Bristol Bay salmon.
Let's come back to that one in just a minute here, but let me also ask you about Board of Fish. It's just a few weeks away here. There are quite a few proposals that could change things if they are adopted, permit stacking, transfer times, and such. What's the RSDA's role at Board of Fish in your mind?
You know, the BBRSDA was designed under certain criteria that they don't engage in activities at the Board of Fish level and lobby the Board of Fish on behalf of their members or the RSDA for that matter.
Okay, so kind of a backseat role there, stay out of the politics of the potential regulatory changes.
Yeah, generally speaking, we should be staying out of the politics and really using the monies of our members wisely.
In the past, the RSDA has funded a number of projects throughout the fishery, including a reporting position here at KDLG, we should note. But right now, the state's budget is crunching down, and we're looking at some counting tower projects that may not happen next year. Is the RSDA looking at stepping in to fill any of those voids from the state's shrinking funding?
You know, we've had some discussion with the Department of Fish and Game and talked a little bit about the counting towers. I think that's a very important project that was funded through the RSDA. And we'll look to see where we could help in those issues. But I think, generally speaking, the early tower counting is very important to our members. And in some cases could possibly offset the 1% that's paid in by our members by having an extra opener or an early opener in regards to early tower counting.
Let's come back to the marketing topic here. We're looking at a forecast of somewhere between 46 and 50-some-odd million more sockeye returning. Looks like it'll be another big year. Prices this year, nobody seemed happy with at all. On top of two other big years, what's the RSDA looking at doing to maybe move some of this product in the world here?
We have a marketing committee that's been working on a plan to really highlight Bristol Bay sockeye. And I think there's really no silver bullet in addressing the amount of fish that we've recently seen in the past season and then what they're predicting for this upcoming season. But the RSDA is going to be working proactively to engage not only its members, but at the same time processors to see what we could do collectively to advance Bristol Bay sockeye.
You know, we've got this fantastic biology happening here, but it's taking a dent in the bottom line of many people's operations and businesses. It seems like people are almost a little bit gloomy to see such a big forecasted return. Is that the sense you're getting from your colleagues and the members of the RSDA?
Yeah, that's been a wet blanket on everybody's pride as far as the fishery goes. You know, we have one of the most robust fisheries in the world. But it certainly presents problems from an economic point of view when it softens the market.
Well, Abe Williams is the president of the RSDA board and a drift net fisherman speaking to us from Naknek this morning. Abe, thanks so much for the time as always.
Thank you.
Well, if you find yourself gloomy about the fishery or anything else this fall, we've got something now that'll hopefully perk you up a bit, and someone special to deliver this interesting bit of news. Bob King was the KDLG news director from 1978 to 1994, the voice of Bristol Bay as none others before him or since have been. He's also a history buff, as many know. Well, Bob has been crunching the numbers and is here now to tell us through this KDLG essay that next July, a commercial fisherman will land the 2 billionth salmon caught in Bristol Bay's 133-year fishing history.
Since the canned salmon industry came to Bristol Bay in 1884, fishermen have landed 1.99 billion salmon, 93% of which were sockeye. Fishermen will hit the 2 billion salmon milestone when they catch another 9.5 million, and that'll happen next season, based on Fish and Game's recently released forecast for a harvest of almost 30 million sockeye in 2016. Catching the 2 billion salmon is an opportunity to reflect on Bristol Bay's salmon resource, its value to fishermen in the state, and the reason for its health. 2 billion salmon is about 12 billion pounds of high-quality protein that's in demand around the world. Fishermen earned $5 billion from that catch. It's the product of a fishery that's healthy and sustainable. The success of the Bristol Bay salmon fishery can be attributed to the region's tremendously productive natural habitat, the science-based management of the resource, and a shared commitment to stewardship by the state, fishermen, and seafood processors. Salmon elsewhere around the world have not fared as well. On the Atlantic coast and Pacific Northwest, salmon stocks have suffered from overfishing, dams, loss of habitat, and pollution. Bristol Bay wasn't immune from such threats. Stocks were overfished in the early years and hammered by high seas fleets. In the 1950s, Bristol Bay runs crashed. Then came Alaska statehood, bringing a constitutional commitment to sustainability. Fish and Game took that charge seriously, applying new science and management tools. Processors supplemented that work, funding the University of Washington's Fisheries Research Institute. The University of Alaska added to those efforts, as did the locally funded Bristol Bay Science and Research Institute. Rebuilding salmon runs didn't come easy. It required sacrifice on the part of fishermen and processors that were hard on many, but it paid off. Combined with favorable natural conditions, it resulted in the unprecedented harvests Bristol Bay produced in recent decades. It took 95 years for Bristol Bay to produce its first billion salmon. The 2 billionth fish will come just 38 years after that. That 1 billionth salmon was caught on the afternoon of June 28, 1978, in the Nooshigak. At the end of the 1977 season, the Bristol Bay catch stood at 998 million salmon, 2 million short of the billion fish mark. The 1978 season started slowly as fishermen and processors haggled over sockeye prices. Early in the season, 700,000 salmon were landed, but fishing ground to a halt as price talks dragged on. Finally, fishermen and processors reached a settlement on June 27th, and the fleet went out. In 12-hour openings that day in the Naknek, Kwijak, and Igigik districts, fishermen landed 900,000 salmon, boosting the total to 1.6 million. Then the Nooshigak opened the next morning, and when it closed at 6 p.m. on June 28th, another 660,000 salmon had been landed, including the billionth fish. It was probably a sockeye, but one in five salmon landed that day on the Nooshigak was a chum. It also could have been a Chinook. The 78 season was pretty good for king salmon, but only 3,000 were landed that day. Rarer still, it could have been a pink salmon. 1978 would be a record year for pinks in Bristol Bay, but that day only five were landed. Whoever catches the 2 billionth salmon next year will never be known. Fishing will probably be fast and furious when next year's catch tops 9.5 million. Anyone could claim credit for catching the 2 billionth salmon. And everyone should, because management and preservation of a resource as valuable as Bristol Bay is a shared long-term responsibility of fishermen, processors, the state, and federal government. While we celebrate this milestone of history, we should keep our focus on Bristol Bay's future, because challenges remain. Climate change, warming ocean temperatures, and increased acidification pose potential threats to the high seas' survival of salmon. The state's current budget woes threaten funding for needed research and management efforts. With continued scientific management of the salmon resource, maintaining the fish's natural habitat, and a little good luck, Bristol Bay fishermen might look forward to catching its 3 billionth salmon in 2054. Good luck and good fishing. I'm Bob King.
That's the shoals and the rapids where the current runs strong. Past 100 different dangers that make the odds so long. No matter how impossible their ancient journey seems, the salmon swim upstream. The salmon swim upstream.
It's always nice to hear from our alumni. This is Bristol Bay and Beyond. Let's take a closer look now at those standardized tests known as AMP, the results of which were released this week and were low. Now, some groups are calling for AMP to be replaced, while the contractor says it can fix the problems ahead of next spring's test. Hannah Colton covers education for KDLG and has been following these issues for us and APRN this week. Hannah, thanks for covering and thanks for joining.
Thanks, Dave.
Okay, so when did students take this AMP test, by the way?
Students in grades 3 through 10 took this test last spring for the first time.
Okay, and the results are just now out this week.
Right.
And they don't look good.
Right. The results showed that only about 35% of students met standards for language arts, and a little less than that, 31% met standards for math.
This is statewide?
Yeah, this is statewide.
What about our results here close to home?
So three of the districts in the Bristol Bay area had scores pretty close to statewide numbers. The Bristol Bay Borough Schools had slightly higher rates than state numbers. And Dillingham and Lake and Peninsula Borough had numbers just below. And then for the Southwest Region School District, they had significantly lower rates. Just under 4% of students met standards in both categories.
Okay, the numbers don't look good, but there's other things people are unhappy about off the bat. Break down for us what some of the disappointment is this week.
A group of superintendents wrote to the state school board. Their main concern was that the scores don't tell educators enough about where individual students are struggling or excelling. So they say that the test is rather arbitrary and not very useful. Then from Commissioner Hanley's perspective, he wasn't happy with the way the contractor delivered the scores. So there were some reporting glitches that caused several weeks of delays.
This is Alaska's Education Commissioner Mike Hanley.
Right.
Okay, now the company who administered and developed this test and did the reporting and the scoring and all the rest, they're out of Kansas. This is a new contract for them, and you spoke with them yesterday. What did they have to say about their end of things?
Yeah, so the contractor is called the Achievement and Assessment Institute. I spoke to Marianne Perry, who manages the program that developed AMP. They said a couple things. For one, the technical delays, they said, had a lot to do with some challenges that they don't face in Kansas. So she said Alaska students have a lot more mobility. There were a lot of students that changed schools or even districts within the testing window, so they had to figure that out. Some of the school districts didn't know how to code things right in the new system. So she said the data is totally valid. It just needed a lot of cleanup.
So this company has heard the complaints from Alaska and from superintendents across the state. What are they going to do about it?
So Perry said they do have a plan to add a part of the test that would give more specific information. It's called performance tasks. So these tests wouldn't be added until the 2016-2017 school year, but they would be new parts of the test that would have to be graded by humans and not computers. So we're talking about written essays and math problems where you have to show work.
This is a major contract for this company. I'm sure that they do not want to lose this contract. They want to keep AMP in place.
Right, of course.
Do we have any sense on whether that's likely or not? There's even a bill now that's asking to replace it. Do we have any sense yet, or is that to be determined in the weeks ahead?
Well, Commissioner Hanley said he'll be meeting with both AAI soon and also the group of superintendents. So he said his preference would be to get the AMP test fixed, but it remains to be seen.
All right, Hannah Colton on the Education Beat for KDLG. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. Thanks for staying with us. The winds were howling this week in southwest Alaska, as they often do this time of year. Around the region, there are a few windmills dotting the landscape, creating some but not lots of energy. Some are private. Others, like in Kakanak, are attempting to serve the village at large. Some, like the one at the courthouse outside of my window here, sit idle, unrepaired, useless. In Dillingham, the idea of putting up wind turbines has long seemed an attractive means of making use of renewable energy. A way to burn less diesel, maybe drive down power costs. Right now, the Nooshgak Cooperative is negotiating with a private wind power company that wants to put up its own turbines, then sell the power back to the co-op. Let's be clear, nothing has been signed or agreed to yet. But despite its green appeal, wind power is tricky. For more, I'm joined by UAF Professor of Environmental Studies, Dr. Todd Radenbaugh, who says one of the most important things to keep in mind is that society has come to expect a stable source of power.
Wind is not stable, as we all know. It's variable. You can have gusts of wind. You can have different weather patterns. You can have all sorts of variation within your wind power. So then how do you stabilize that wind source?
How do you stabilize it? What are people doing now?
The easiest way to stabilize at this point is use your diesel generators. So there is some newer technology where you can ramp up and ramp down diesel generations. We don't have those in Dillingham, of course, to try to modulate. If you have too much wind power and you're afraid to turn off your diesel generator because you're afraid that the wind would die down, you're generating too much power. So then you have to have a sink for that extra energy that comes out of the wind. So you can put into, we call it resistive heating. You can make hot water. You can just dump it. You can spend more money now and start using some new technologies like flywheels. Those have been shown to be quite effective.
But then on the flip side, there are times you're not going to have enough.
That's where you have to store the power in some form of battery.
Do we have that technology yet?
The battery technology is getting bigger in terms of chemical batteries. And we've looked at tractor trailers, basically, that are just stocked full of, should we say, the newest lithium ion or whatever. There's certain different battery technologies that you can just drop the trailer off, and you got 20, 30 minutes, an hour of a megawatt of power in a trailer. And that is a great backup source to maybe modulate wind power.
But it's also not as easy as what people might think just to turn the generator back, just to turn the diesel generator back on.
You cannot just turn diesel generators on and off.
Why not?
That easily. It's just, there's bearings, it takes a while to start.
Meaning it's more likely the diesel generators would stay on, regardless of what the wind turbines are producing. Radenbaugh cites a place like Kodiak Island, which draws most of its power from hydro, which is stable, some from wind, with the diesel generators now available as backup. The key there is the hydro coming from Kodiak's Terror Lake, which provides 80% or more of the island's electrical needs.
So in the perfect world, we'd want something similar to that. It's difficult in the Dillingham region because, one, we've looked at potential sites in the state park, and they just were too far away, and they weren't producing enough power to make it economically feasible. So we don't have that aspect. The other issue is our winds close to where we have our power lines, like especially our three-phase power lines, which we would need in order to power our grid, don't exist. We need height, I guess is the best way to say it. On top of a mountain, we do have class 5 and 6 winds in the Dillingham region, but we need to get pretty high to get away from ground and building turbulence. And that means a big windmill.
Why are those a problem, would you say? Why couldn't we put up a whole bunch of big windmills off the VOR?
That actually is a pretty good site. Wind comes off of, especially from the south, off the Nooshgak Bay. And we have put in a proposal for windmills at that site, but they really need to be tall and they need to be big. So putting in one of those GE 1 megawatt beautiful windmills that would work quite well here, one, would be very expensive. Secondly, the cranes that would require to put a windmill or two like that up. would cost almost as much as the actual windmill itself to try to rent and bring a crane up here on a barge. You need to have a location where you have consistently strong winds, and your windmills need to be able to capture that wind as much of the year as possible. There are sites in the Bristol Bay region where location is key and could work. But in order to get that power to the places that we use it is distribution. And distribution of electricity is super expensive, first. And secondly, some would say it's environmentally problematic to have electric grids all over the place, or everything from bird strikes to just visible blight to them sinking in swamps because we've got so many in the tundra. I'm not advocating putting power grids and connecting these small rural villages, because that's not cost effective either. If you go well into the future from now, I think where we should be thinking about is the small scale grid that's efficient, and you can have multiple sources that can use the renewable energy of a location.
Meaning neighborhoods could power themselves off of turbines or solar or small hydro. He admits that's down the road and would be costly to develop. Redmell says even as technologies to harness wind, sun, and water to create electricity are improving, none yet seem better than diesel at providing the stable, steady power that Dillingham has come to expect.
If we were become, I don't know how to say this, if you're going to become totally dependent on wind, you lose a safety factor that we don't have with diesel. Diesel, there's a lot of energy in a gallon of diesel. It's a beautiful battery in itself. It's a great way to produce electricity and ship the energy source around.
But nobody likes the carbon footprint.
But then we've...
Or the cost, until recently.
It doesn't negate the importance of diesel. I mean, we wouldn't be talking if it wasn't for diesel. And I don't want to be an advocate of diesel, because I really, in my heart of hearts, I want to be renewable. Our society in Dillingham, I don't think, is ready for that.
Dr. Todd Radenbaugh, professor of environmental studies at University of Alaska Fairbanks, located in the Bristol Bay campus. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And we've invited Dr. Radenbaugh back to talk about why the hydro proved unfeasible at Lakes Grant and Elva in the Wood-Tikchik State Park. We'll bring you that conversation at a later date. This is Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. Back in a moment. Well, finally this week, those Dillingham Lady Wolverines get to play at home this weekend, minus a few of their seniors who are attending a leadership conference in Anchorage. Dillingham is doing well this season, and Smart Money is on them making another good bid for the 2A state title. I asked their coach, Megan Slagle, to give us her subjective take on the team, and she sat down with me earlier this morning. Thanks, as always.
Yeah.
So it's exciting to have a home tournament, first of all. Are the girls and the fans and everybody pumped, as best you can tell?
Yeah, finally. The girls have been talking about it for weeks now to be on our home turf. So I think we're ready to have some home games this weekend.
Does it take a bit of a toll to always be on the road for all these games, both for morale and for, you know, your personal life, I suppose?
Yeah, I think it's tough. I always tell these girls if they want to play college sports, they are more than prepared, because when you're in college, you miss at least Thursday and Friday of every week during your season, and that's what we're doing pretty much. So,
well, I know that everybody gets excited when all the action comes back to whoever's hometown it is, and, mm-hmm. and this is Dillingham's chance this weekend. Tell us that haven't seen the girls play yet how good they are this year, the Lady Wolverines.
Our volleyball team is solid this year. We've got a strong group of seniors. We have Sydney Dre, Sarah Schroeder, Savannah Sage, lots of S's. And then Emma Wetter on our varsity team, and all four of them have come on strong this year. And then our underclassmen, too, have come on strong. So as a whole, we are solid.
You've beat a number of 3A teams.
Yeah, when we went up to Barrow a couple weeks ago, we played in their tournament, and we were the only 2A team there. And we ended up taking first place. And I think that was the high of the season. The girls were pretty excited about being the 2A team who ended up winning. So we're proud of that one.
What's the toughest competition you've seen so far?
I would say Cordova.
And they're right on the 2A, 3A line.
Yeah, they just switched to 2A this year.
Mm-hmm. Right, they're a big school.
Yeah, when we saw them in Anchorage, we lost to them twice in pool play and then for the championship game. So every day at practice, we talk about how that's what the competition's going to be like at state, and if we want to compete at state, we need to work hard in practice so that next time we see them, we're more prepared.
Let's talk about state briefly. You'll probably see some of the perennials of Kluwak, Craig, Sioux Valley. Unalaska Field's a tough team every year. Hooper mm-hmm. Bay sometimes. Kalinganik even.
Mm-hmm.
Who do you have your sights set on? We don't know how the bracket will shake out yet. I'm sure that you'll be at state, but mm-hmm. we don't know which side of the bracket you'll be on. But what do you think about the Kluwak, Craig, Sioux Valley that always pester Dillingham's hopes and dreams?
Yeah, I think state this year is going to be a battle. There's multiple teams in this tournament who are going to be vying for that state title, who have a really good shot at it. So I think it's just going to end up being more of a mental thing. Who's mentally stronger, who can withstand that pressure and come out on top? So.
All right. Looking forward to an exciting weekend of play here in Dillingham, and glad to have head coach Megan Slagle joining us. Thanks so much.
Yeah, good luck. For having me, Dave.
And that's it for this week's show. You can find this and past episodes of Bristol Bay and Beyond online at the KDLG website. I'm your host, Dave Benninger. Shoot me an email with feedback and story ideas, or write us an essay like Bob King did. Dave at KDLG.org, or give us a call here at the station. We're glad to be your public radio station in Bristol Bay. Thanks for joining us. Have a great weekend and enjoy this bit of snow before next week's rain washes it all away. We'll see you back here next week.